Things changed dramatically for me in 1988. And that summer, the Iranian regime had my father killed. But the thing is that it wasn't only my father. That summer, 30,000 political prisoners were executed in about 5, 6 weeks in Iran. And the devastation was immense for the people of Iran. And in fact, with that, Khomeini was able to spread fear in society for over a decade. The day that the ceasefire was signed between Iran and Iraq, the mass executions began based on a fatwa, a religious decree given by Khomeini, and 30,000 people were executed. And that change shifted everything in Iran until I think the first time we saw a major uprising form again in Iran was the summer of 1999. So, summer of 1999 was also a turning point for me because it was the summer that I had just graduated from high school. I was on the path of, I'd gotten a full scholarship. I was going to go and pursue medicine. That was the life path ahead of me. But when I saw the scenes coming out from Iran of students, people from our generation, taking to the streets and then being brutally suppressed, we saw university students being thrown off buildings and things of that nature.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Easy Conversations podcast, a podcast about having easy conversations. I'm your host, Furkan Dandia. In this week's episode, I welcome Zolal Habibi for a powerful discussion about Iran, human rights, political repression, women's leadership, and the ongoing struggle for freedom. We talk about a lot of the nuances behind this situation in Iran, which perhaps we're not understanding based on what's being portrayed in the media. There's more to it than what meets the eye, and Zolal helps us understand that in this episode, where she draws from her own personal history, including the execution of her father during the 1988 massacre. Zolal speaks about the human cost of tyranny and the importance of amplifying the voices of political prisoners, dissidents, and freedom seekers. In this episode, we talk about Zolal's personal story, political prisoners and dissidents, women's empowerment and leadership, misogyny, tyranny, and state control, why simplistic regime change narratives fail, the human rights situation inside Iran, resistance movements inside and outside Iran, hope, memory, and moral courage. Zolal Habibi has spent over 25 years of dedicated activism. She has become a fierce advocate for the voiceless inside Iran, regularly appearing at international forums, human rights conferences, and podcasts. As an Iranian-American, she offers a perspective rooted in both Iran and the West. Her activism began in her teens, shaped by the loss of her father, a respected Iranian writer and political dissident who was killed by the regime during the 1988 massacre when she was only 7. This tragedy ignited a lifelong commitment to ensuring that no other family suffers such loss, and that the voices of Iran's political prisoners, dissidents, and freedom seekers are heard on the world stage. At 18, Zolal faced a crossroad where she could have either continued her education and pursue a medical degree or dedicate her life to bringing freedom to Iran. Along this path, she has developed profound experience in women's empowerment and leadership, Middle Eastern geopolitics, the climate inside Iran, opposition and resistance movements, the women's movement, human rights, terrorism, warmongering, and nuclear ambitions. And before we jump into the episode, a quick reminder that listening to this podcast does not establish a therapeutic relationship. The contents of this podcast are for informational and educational purposes only. If you do require support, please reach out to a licensed clinician. And let's just jump into the episode now. Hey, Zolal, welcome to Easy Conversations. Thank you for joining me today. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. I think there's a lot of nuance behind what we're seeing in the world today. And your story is obviously very inspiring, but there's also tragedy involved. So I think what I heard from you in our previous conversation is you've been able to find meaning through the work you're doing, based on your past experiences. So I'm sure we'll get into all of that. But yeah, there's a lot of information we're hearing in the news, in the media, and unfortunately, it's not always accurate. And that was the other thing I realized in our previous conversation. But before we get into all of that, I do want to give you an opportunity to share with the listeners a little bit about yourself and who you are and what brings you here today.
First of all, thank you very much for this opportunity and allow me to greet those who are tuning into the podcast today. It's a pleasure to be with you. As you mentioned, my name is Zonon Habibi, and I am a member of the Iranian Resistance. I'm a member of the NCRI Foreign Affairs Committee, and have dedicated the past practically 27 years of my life to the cause of freedom in Iran. And yeah, so we work tirelessly to be able to hopefully see the dawn of freedom in our country. That, I think that sums it up.
Yeah, we'll definitely get into the details of that. But what allowed you, or I think the better question is, what inspired you to join this movement? And what's allowed you to continue to stay with it, right? And sometimes what I see is when we take on these types of initiatives, it's not always encouraging, right? There's moments where you're not seeing the outcomes. It can feel discouraging. So how do you keep yourself engaged and motivated and keep showing up?
Well, how did I get involved in the first place? I belong to the generation that was born after the 1979 revolution. So ever since my childhood was at a time that we were seeing this new wave of executions in Iran, the 1980s, which was a very devastating decade for the people of Iran, because on one hand, they had the mass executions. Practically 100,000 people were executed in the 80s in Iran for their political affiliation. On the other hand, we had an 8-year war with Iraq. So the country was in a very bad place. And I grew up with that reality, even though growing up, I knew that this is what the reality that is going on in Iran, even though we were abroad. My parents came to the US before the revolution. So I've actually never been to Iran myself. But because of my parents' activism and their work, I got introduced to the situation in Iran very early on. I think like the first protest that I went to, I was only 3 days old. So you can imagine the rest of it. But aside from that, because of my father was a writer and a prominent human rights activist, I remember meeting people who were like victims of torture when I was about 4 or 5 years old, who had been able to escape from Iran and had come to testify at the United Nations and in the US Congress back then. And so they were staying at our house for 2 weeks. They became my real life superheroes for me. And so that was always part and parcel of my life. But I always thought, that's in Iran and we're here, we're safe. Things changed dramatically for me in 1988. And that summer, the Iranian regime had my father killed. But the thing is that it wasn't only my father. That summer, 30,000 political prisoners were executed in about 5-6 weeks in Iran. And the devastation was immense for the people of Iran. And in fact, with that, Khomeini was able to spread fear in society for over a decade. The day that the ceasefire was signed between Iran and Iraq, the mass executions began based on a fatwa, a religious decree given by Khomeini. And 30,000 people were executed. And that change shifted everything in Iran until I think the first time we saw a major uprising form again in Iran was the summer of 1999. So summer of 1999 was also a turning point for me because it was the summer that I had just graduated from high school. I was on the path of, I got a full scholarship. I was going to go and pursue medicine. That was the life path ahead of me. But when I saw the scenes coming out from Iran of students, people from our generation, taking to the streets and then being brutally suppressed, we saw university students being thrown off buildings and things of that nature. And it was the first time that an uprising was actually being broadcasted because it was the start of cable television and cable news and whatnot. Yes. And I remember seeing those scenes and thinking, I can't just be a bystander and just watch this happen. Yeah. And then hope that they will succeed and then what we could go to Iran. They can't be the ones who are paying the price for our freedom. and then for me to just be looking at it from abroad. That was the turning point for me, and I decided to join the resistance instead, and I guess take the path that's followed in society in general. Since then, I have been a member of the resistance. And as you said, there are a lot of ups and downs. We have seen, unfortunately, especially because there is a policy of appeasement toward the Iranian regime, we've had major ups and downs, and just sometimes injustices that you face that it's not even comprehensible at any level. Just to give you the latest example of it was this weekend. We had been organizing for a rally against executions in Iran, marking the 45th anniversary of the peaceful protest in Tehran, which Khomeini opened fire on. And it's the day, the Remembrance Day of Martyrs and Political Prisoners, June 20th. And so we were marking that, and we organized a huge rally in Paris. 100,000 people were expected to be attending. And in the 90th minute, the French authorities decided to cancel the permission for the rally. That's something that they had approved of from April. And even the last setups with the police, like for instance to go and see everything on the ground and everything had been done like on Wednesday or whatnot, and we're just waiting for the paper permit, because in France you receive the paper permit like 24 hours before the rally. And so we're just waiting for that, and everything was like, for instance, some of these production companies and everything, they were already on the ground when that statement came that they've canceled the permission. And unfortunately, that same day or in the week leading to the rally, we witnessed that Iran's foreign minister and the French foreign minister had 5 phone calls, and some of them very extensive, some shorter. But it was clear that one of the things that they're pushing for, the Iranian regime is pushing for, is the cancellation of this. And we were able to take it to court that same day, because it didn't really leave us much room. Yep. It was, just imagine, it was like Thursday at 8:00 p.m. They give this email that, oh, your permission has been revoked. And then Friday morning, we took this to court. By the time the courts actually are able to process it and take a look and have a court session, the response came Saturday morning when people were already there on the scenes, and they said it is to some extent because of threats by the regime that they're going to carry out a bombing in this event, and because of that France decided to cancel the event. And unfortunately, the protesters who were already there like 8:00 in the morning, they were met with police brutality, even though they are people who were victims. I saw footage of people who were being beaten in the streets that I recognized, because they were former political prisoners themselves, someone who spent her childhood in prison, or people who had their loved ones killed, their spouses, their children, or their parents, and they were the ones who were being attacked. And so it does make you think sometimes, how much injustice. Do they not see what's happening in Iran? Do they not see the executions? Do they not see how innocent people are being killed? And how do they turn a blind eye on that? So that is, unfortunately, a reality fight. But we have learned to be persistent, not to give in and not to give up, and to continue, because we understand that, yes, Iran is a complex issue, because Iran plays a very important geopolitical role. Iran is a rich country in natural resources, but it's also, unfortunately, the number one state sponsor of international terrorism. Mm. So all of that comes into play. And that just increases our responsibility. And we know that, I guess we understand that we're not up against a classical dictatorship, so it's going to be harder. But when you look at it from a historic perspective, if you look back in history, all of the religious dictatorships that we've seen in history, they usually tend to last 300 to 500 years, because they legitimize their suppression and everything that they do under the name of religion and God. With the fight that we have continuously fought in the last 47 years, I think that there isn't anyone, even within the regime, that can deny that the regime has entered its final phase and it's on the verge of. So that 500 year has been turned to 47 years now. And I think that, yes, when you look at it in our own time, you feel like this is why is it taking so long? Why all of these brutalities and everything? But when you look at it from the context of history, you realize that because there has been this continuous fight, because you've never given in, you've been able to, you know, squeeze that time and actually be able to expedite the whole process. And I think that's really important to keep in mind, because otherwise you just drown in seeing all of these. I remember a friend of mine used to say that we see the light at the end of the tunnel. We just don't know if it's the next train coming to run us over or it's actually the light at the end of the tunnel. It has been also a marathon. And I think one of the, actually a Ukrainian MP was speaking to me, right? It was when they were in, I think it was 1 year had passed since the start of the war. And she was like, how do you guys do it? How do you guys keep your morale? How do you keep consistent and continue despite all the hardships? And after explaining and everything, she told me something. She said, there are those in life who are, they may be runners, but some run a sprint, some run a marathon. Not everyone who runs a sprint can run a marathon, because the marathon needs continuation, right, and persistence. And you guys are the ones who are running that marathon right now. I think that has always helped. But also, I think I gain a lot of my strength from the values that this resistance stands for, because I think it really does help to know that you are on the right side of history. And the fact that we're standing by our principles and our values, I think one of the most cherished realities about this resistance is it has been able to maintain its independence, both politically and financially. And I think that has been the key for us, because we have, that allows us, it gives us the strength and also the ability or capability to be able to not budge from the rights of our people and keep our concentration just on that main goal, instead of having to give in to the requests or whatever of those people that you're independent on, because there are strings attached, unfortunately. And fortunately, we didn't have that. And even though it does make it difficult, because being independent means you need to be able to finance yourself. And we have done so. The Iranian people, the Iranian diaspora, and human, I guess, philanthropists or people who have good hearts have helped us throughout these years. But that has been very key, that we've been able to keep our independence.
Yeah, no, I appreciate all that. And there's a lot of questions I have, so I'll try to be mindful of everything I want to ask. But you're talking about having this independent movement and all the people involved. How do you then separate, because there's always a tendency for people to have their own personal interests that can get in the way of the movement itself. So how do you make sure everyone's aligned, and when there are personal interests getting in the way, how do you address those issues? Because generally speaking, there's always bad actors anywhere you go, right? So how do you keep that at the forefront and also keep people in check?
That is actually, I think, one of the most interesting aspects of this movement. It is also one of the aspects that is used tremendously by the regime for demonizing the movement. Everyone that you see in this movement, especially the members, I'm talking about the members and not the supporters. The supporters are like vast hundreds of thousands of people around, or millions inside of Iran, who support this movement. But I'm talking about the core, which are like the members of this resistance. They have, for the most part, dedicated their lives to this cause. When you see that kind of dedication, like, for instance, just to give you an example, like Mrs. Rajavi, she's the president-elect of the National Council of Resistance of Iran for the interim government after the fall of the mullahs. Some ask, what guarantees are there that she's not just after power? That guarantee, to me, as someone who has known her firsthand, like, personally experienced being with her and working with her, but also as someone who has had her as my role model throughout my life, I see that a dedication that comes based on the two main principles or values of this movement. This entire movement is based on two values. One is integrity and honesty, and the second is sacrifice. And she has been a member of this movement since she was 19. She is now 72. So that's over 5 decades of dedication, day in, day out, without one single day of a break. And someone who gives that kind of dedication, if they were after power, if they were after becoming rich or whatever other interest, there were easier ways to gain that.
Yeah.
Her two sisters have been killed. One of her sisters was killed during the Shah's time. One was executed in 1982 because they were trying to extract information from her about the whereabouts of her sister. She was 6 months pregnant when she was killed. So that kind of sacrifice within the family and the continuation. And the reality is that since 1985, she has had on her shoulders the weight of overthrowing this regime. At the end of the day, I'm just a member. People usually say that is amazing that you dedicated your life this way or whatnot. But when they look at her, it's what people expect from her. Why haven't you overthrown the regime yet? You know? And having that responsibility on your shoulder, I think that just puts everything in a different perspective. I think one of the most important aspects of this movement is the fact that they realized from very early on that to be able to overthrow this regime, it goes farther than just politics. It's ideological because this is a misogynist regime. It's a religious dictatorship. And so they realize that, okay, if you want to fight it, you need to be able to put aside your ego and be able to concentrate on sacrificing everything for your people. Mm. And that has been a whole process. It has taken decades, but I think that we have been able to accomplish things that are unprecedented, I think, in history, probably. Hopefully one day the world will learn more about it. And now you see it replicated inside of Iran. You see it in the resistance units. You see it in those who are being executed on a daily basis, unfortunately, since the ceasefire in the war, recent war between the U.S. and Iran. Since the ceasefire, the regime has executed over 30 political prisoners, 8 of which were members of this resistance, and many of them were protesters who were arrested just in January of this year. So within some of them, even within 40 days of their arrest, they had been executed already. But I think that if you look at the messages that they sent out, some of them were able to send out messages, audio notes, letters, anything before their executions. And in it, what is that those two principles that I said, their honesty and their self-sacrifice. And I think that has been key. That is what opens the path, because the regime feels like even though they were in chains, they were the ones who were bringing the henchmen to their knees. They had no other choice than executing them because these people were not going to budge from their beliefs and what they stand for. And they're like, you know what? We are standing on the right side of history. We will overthrow you. One of them said, we are going to be the last generation that's going to be executed by this regime because the days of this regime are numbered. So someone who goes to gallows with that kind of a motivation, that sends a message to society and it inspires, it gives strength to those who are standing against the regime.
Yeah, for sure. And I just want to get a better understanding of some of the historical stuff that you've touched on. So you talked about the 1979 revolution where the Shah was overthrown. What was the state like before 1979, and why did the revolution happen? Are you able to give us a brief understanding just to ground the listeners? Because I think, again, the historical information, even though it's from 1979, plays a huge role in the whole context of this conversation that we're having.
Yeah, it definitely does. Right now with the situation of Iran, it's very important to understand the 1979 revolution. At the time, because there's a lot of people who just automatically assume if you don't want the mullahs, So you have to revert back to the previous system, which is not the case. The people of Iran want to move forward to an actual democratic republic in Iran. During the Shah's time, you have to understand that the Shah was a puppet state. The Shah was, his father was actually brought in through a military coup by the British. And once he wasn't serving their purposes anymore, and because they were afraid of his alliance with Hitler, because he had this issue of like, we're the Aryan race, you guys are the Aryan race, so we should be working together. And unfortunately, because of that, he was put in exile. They brought him his son, Mahmud Reza Pahlavi. And at first, because he didn't even have the might that his father did, he tried to stay in check with the British. When that happened, that opened a vacuum in society because people had the 1906 constitutional revolution. They wanted to create like a constitutional monarchy, at least. If we're going to have a monarchy, let it have some kind of representation, some kind of like democratic systems in it. For the first time, the people of Iran actually chose their prime minister, and that was Dr. Mossadegh. Mm. Dr. Mossadegh nationalized Iran's oil. That was not to the benefit of the Western powers at that time, because at that time, Iran only received about, I think, 6% of the income of Iran's oil. The rest would go to British Petroleum and other companies. And so the US and UK wanted to cut that off. They didn't want that. So unfortunately, there was a coup d'etat carried out against Dr. Mossadegh, and he was overthrown, and the Shah was reinstated. And from that day on, the Shah ruled with an iron fist because he felt he had the backing of the US and the UK to do. And we saw the growth of the SAVAK, the secret police, and the execution of political prisoners. Every organization or association was forbidden to form in Iran. Iran became a one-party state. And the Shah said, if you don't like it, either leave the country or you're going to be arrested. Mm. And we saw writers, poets, the intellectuals being executed back then. And unfortunately, if you look at the Amnesty annual reports, if you look at back like 1976, right now we're 2026. Back then, Iran was the number one state in executions per capita. Today, Iran is the number one state in execution per capita. So it was pretty much the same systems to be able to suppress. And the people of Iran wanted change. They didn't. Poverty was skyrocketing in Iran. And then at the same time, we had the Shah celebrating the 2,500 years of monarchy in Iran with lavish celebrations while people were literally not only under the line of poverty, but didn't have food on their table. So that was a turning point for a lot of Iranians too. And so the people of Iran overthrew the Shah. One thing that did help was that due to the human rights policy of President Carter, Iran did stop execution and torture. So that allowed people to come to the streets. Everyone was like, okay, at the end of the day, if you get killed in a protest, you might. That's the risk. But if you're arrested, you're not going to get killed. Mm. And that emboldened society to be able to come out to the streets. And it took 18 months since the day that the execution and tortures were stopped till the overthrow of the Shah. Once it became clear that the Shah was literally about to fall apart and he wasn't going to be able to keep his grip on power, Western powers were worried about what comes next because it was the Cold War era. Iran has had a very large common border with the USSR, and Iran always played a very important geopolitical role in the region. And as I said, natural resources. So they started thinking about what comes next. Are we going to allow those progressive movements who have been fighting for this revolution to take over, which their heads have mostly been executed in prison or are still imprisoned as political prisoners, or what are our options? So they went to Khomeini. Khomeini was in exile at that time in Iraq. The last 6 months before the revolution, he came to Paris. He had negotiations with Western powers. And he made promises to them, empty promises, but he made promises. And they chose to bring in Khomeini because they said, at the end of the day, we know that he opposes the USSR because they're communists and they don't believe in God, and he looks at that as being evil or whatnot. So we have that guarantee there. So maybe it's to our benefit to have him. And he's also made these promises. But the minute Khomeini took power, he did as he wished. It wasn't what they were looking for. And the people of Iran have paid the price for that since then. So those who try to paint a rosy image of the time of the Shah, it really wasn't. Mm. The Shah was known for its brutality, for its, even some say, women's rights during the Shah. If you look at the interviews of the Shah, you understand what a misogynist creep he was, really. Mm. And at the same time, it's really important to understand. Just imagine in 50 years, people will be saying like, oh, Khomeini was great. During his time, the people of Iran got internet and social media and this and that. I'm like, it's with the times. It happens. It has nothing to do with that regime. Just to say that people were living, people had electricity or water or whatever, and they didn't even in the towns in Iran, but in villages, it was just in major cities. That doesn't mean the Shah actually brought modernism or anything like that to Iran.
Yeah.
So it's important to understand that context.
Yes, and in present times, there's a lot of, I think, romanticism around the Shah's son. I believe there's been conversations. His name's Reza Pahlavi, right? So there's a lot of conversations that people want to see him come into power. And what I'm hearing from you is even in the Shah's time, things weren't rosy as people seem to paint the picture. What are your thoughts about his son coming into power and some of the push that's happening there? I would assume he wouldn't be too far away from his own father's views and approach.
I think one other thing that's really important is that, especially in recent months, I think he started to show his true colors. It's made the work a lot easier for us because before we had to try to explain to people. But the reality is that Reza Pahlavi, he actually, in an interview in Sweden just about 2 months ago, he said that I take pride in my father's and my grandpa's legacy. And he is the continuation of the same thing. The fact that he does try to play both cards. He tries to say, oh, I'm just for the interim system, just for the interim transitional government or whatever. Let's not get stuck in the titles. But the fact that he introduces himself everywhere as the crown prince, it just shows that he says, I'm the monarch, right? And the fact that he's introduced his daughter as the heir to the throne, after himself, so that means he's king and his daughter's going to be the next heir. But the reality is that the thing is that for 47 years, Reza Pahlavi has been living in the US. He has not been able to form an organization that lasts for 6 months. He has not done anything concrete for the people of Iran. Put something together, have something to show other than just mere words. And for the most part, he only gave one message a year for the New Year's. And that was because he was forced to, really. So he never took any responsibility. And in fact, he did an interview with a podcast last year. And he said, it's not fair to me or my family to have to go to and live in Iran. Because my life for the past 40 years has been here. My friends are here. Maybe we could find some way to go back and forth. And so Iranians started joking around about it, saying that, oh, he's a Zoom prince. Because he wanted to run Iran through Zoom and live his lavish life in the U.S., which has been funded by the people of Iran with the money that his father took from Iran. On the other hand, last summer, actually, for the first time, he gave a roadmap of his provisional government. It's noteworthy to state that a lot of the basics, some of them were copied from the NCRI's plan. But it's very important to read between the lines. The sections that he has put into it himself, or his team have put into it, it calls for the revival of the Savak. Mm. It says that in the interim government, all the different branches, all three branches, will be responding to him as the provisional leader, and he chooses the heads of those branches. And on the other hand, he calls for martial law in 20 major cities of Iran for the 18 months. Mm. And he says there's no time limit for this interim government.
Mm.
So it's really a blueprint for a authoritarian regime. If you, when you read into it and when you look at the details, and that is alarming, I think, for many Iranians. Yeah. There are this new generation who might not be very informed about what happened back then, because the people of Iran have been living under a dictatorship for 47 years. But there are those who do remember the time of the Shah. There are still people who bear the signs of the tortures from the Shah's time on their bodies. Mm. It's not something that's been forgotten. And one of the things that I think is devastating is just if you look at the since January till now, what the monarchists or supporters of Reza Pahlavi have been doing. First of all, we have one case of an assassination in Canada that the court is ongoing right now. We have people being beaten in streets for not supporting him and not saying long live the king or the Shah or Javed Shah, which is their slogan. And people are being beaten and harassed for that abroad. And you're not even in power yet, and you're already doing that. There are cases right now, court cases in Germany, in the UK, in Austria in this regard. So it's very extensive. It's not just in one place. And actually, I think it was very alarming for us, actually, to see that even with the rally that I told you was cancelled, one of the things that the police raised was the threats made by monarchists that they had said, if you allow this protest to go, this rally to be held, we will turn France into hell. And they named, like the court actually named specific people. And that specific person who was named, he is the top organizer of Reza Pahlavi and his mother's office in France. It's not someone that's not linked directly. It's, you see those direct links. Their main, in the last few months, if you go to one of their protests, you never hear them giving a chant for political prisoners in Iran. Their chants are all in support of the Shah or against anyone who opposes the Shah. And I think those are clear signs. And we see this fascism and parading with Savak t-shirts to the extent that Reza Pahlavi had to come to the scene and be like, it's not to our benefit that you guys wear the Savak t-shirt and rat in protest, or the chants of one country, one flag, one leader, which is the equivalent of what Hitler used to say. And they started saying that in Munich, of all places. And if you have, think of the historic context there. But I think the people of Iran are seeing that. And they are, that's why, like, one of the major, actually, what major issues that is creating solidarity among Iranians now is drawing a line between democratic forces and undemocratic forces. So they say, like the slogan in Farsi, they say, na shah, na sheikh, meaning no to the shah, no to the mullahs. And that is creating a very vast solidarity front on the part of the people right now.
Yeah, no, I appreciate all the context, because I would assume as a person living in Iran, it'd be tough for me personally, if I were to put myself in those shoes, to vote for a leader or support a leader who hasn't even been in the country for 47 years, right? So what does he really know about reality, right? And this comes back to that personal interest, ego piece we were referring to earlier. Now, from a geopolitical standpoint, you talked about the Cold War between the United States and the former USSR, and there's obviously information out there that the USSR was supporting Iran, and then the U.S. was also supporting Iraq in that Iran-Iraq war. So you can make the case that Iran and the U.S. have had their friction for a really long time. There's also conversations around,
it was the hostage taking too in 1980.
Okay. Yes. But then there's the oil piece too, right? So which we're seeing in the current war. Now there's conversations around people here in the West talking about freeing Iranians from the theocracy, right? So what are your thoughts about that? Is that truly their intention? Are they actually helping? There was also, I believe the intention was, by taking out the regime, the local population would rise up against the political movement, right? So that didn't happen. But what are your thoughts about the U.S. getting involved and starting this war now? And I know you had mentioned this to me, so I'm happy to get your thoughts on all of that.
I think it's really important to understand the realities on the ground when you are looking at this scenario. So aside from everything that has happened from February 28th till today, even if you look at the bigger picture, for 22 years, the Iranian resistance has been saying that the solution to Iran is neither war nor appeasement. Mrs. Rajavi first said this at the European Parliament 22 years ago, and she presented a third option, something that became known as the third option. She said, no war, no appeasement, support the people of Iran and their organized resistance to bring about change. This isn't because we are the resistance that we're giving this as the option. It's the reality of understanding Iran and the geopolitics of the region and geographically understanding Iran. So Iran it's not a classical dictatorship. So the scenario, like something like Venezuela, is not possible in Iran. So if you take that top figure out, the system's not going to collapse. And that is what we've seen since February 28th. On February 28th, Khamenei was taken out, but the regime is still standing. The same way that when Khomeini died, Khamenei took his place. So the system stays, because it has a whole apparatus intact, that it stays. So war in this kind of circumstances, that like specific bombings and just eliminating one person or whatever, is not going to be the solution to Iran. It's not going to turn to the regime change. So that's out of the question, and I think the world has seen it now. That's not what's going to happen. I think it was an analysis by one of the U.S. generals that the Iranian regime probably could continue this war for about another 6-7 months. But the reality is that because they are just using like drones, which are pretty cheap, in face of the weaponry that the U.S. was using, which was very expensive, and it was being targeted with these drones, and so it just wasn't a balanced surface for them, and it wouldn't be able to lead to a regime change. On the other hand, when you say they were hoping that when you have these air raids, then the people of Iran will also come to the streets and overthrow this regime, that's also being naive, because like when you have bombs over your head, are you able to go into the streets and protest realistically? And aside, even under normal regime, it wouldn't be possible. But with the current regime, what the regime did is immediately with the war, they had an excuse to suppress internally. They said, look, there's a foreign war, so that's why there's complete martial law. That's why for 80 days, they cut off internet and communication. It wasn't just the internet, it was also phone lines. So cut off all sorts of information or communication for the people of Iran. So it takes away that mobilization factor from the people. They had set up checkpoints that still stand. Practically, they say, if you want to go somewhere in Iran, like a 30-minute distance, you will at least have to go through 2 checkpoints. And in the checkpoints, they're not just checking your car. They will check your phone. During the time that there was the internet blackout, they would check to see when was the last time you've connected to certain apps. Based on that, they would know that you have somehow gone around the internet blackout and you could be taken in for questioning, prison, whatnot. And many have been taken or arrested for that. On the other hand, if you didn't have your phone with you in the checkpoint, that they said, that's a red flag. Why don't you have your phone with you? So you probably have something to hide. So it was intervening in people's most personal aspects of their lives. But also, you have to understand, in January, the situation in Iran was devastating, that people went on a strike because of poverty. And just imagine when we had the uprising, and then there was the complete, back then it was a 19-day internet blackout, and also martial law and whatnot. And then again, the war started, and then again for 80 days. Most people in Iran make their income off the internet. How are they supposed to do that? So even the poverty has gotten worse, especially with the war. Infrastructures were hit. The electricity was cut off for many people in throughout Iran. Water centers were hit. So it's basic infrastructures that were targeted. So that's going to make life even more difficult. So during those circumstances, you can't expect people to be coming to the streets or doing anything. Their hands are literally tied. So that's not realistic. On the other hand, so how are you going to overthrow this regime? If you mean with troops on the ground, a scenario on right, like Iraq is not likely in Iran. Iran is 3 times the size of Iraq, 4 times the population. We have practically every possible terrain you could think of. We have mountain ranges. We have the sea and water. You see right now with the Strait of Hormuz and everything that's going on too. And we have desert, and then we have forests in the north. And whatever side you want to reach Tehran from, you have to go through these type of things. And so that's not likely, and it's not realistic. And we have huge metropolitan cities too. So that's not a reality. And the U.S. knows that. Iran knows that. So the Iranian regime was never afraid of a full-fledged war, because they knew that it would be like quicksand and it would be a death trap for anyone who tries to enter that. On the other hand, so that's also not realistic. So what is the regime doing? We saw because Iran is the number one state sponsor of international terrorism too, its war doesn't stay within the borders of Iran. We saw in this war that 12 other countries were targeted by the Iranian regime. Why? Not, some of them had nothing to do with the war, like Cyprus or other countries who were hit by the regime. Why did the regime do that? Because the regime strives on chaos, on crisis. This has been its key. Khamenei used to say during the Arab Spring, because a lot of Iranians would say, why are we involved in Syria and Yemen and all of these countries? That was one of the slogans that they had in protest. And he was saying that, look, they are our strategic front lines. And it's our defense mechanism. Mm. He said, we don't fight in the streets of Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, Iraq. We will have to fight in the streets of Tehran, Shiraz, Isfahan. And that is exactly what has happened now. If you look at this whole process since the fall of Bashar Assad, the Iranian regime has been on a slippery slope going down. And that's why you see the increase of uprisings inside of the regime, inside of Iran too, because the regime has lost that grip that it had. It's lost its proxy groups. And so it's in a very weak position today. The only thing that they can do is make terrorist threats and whatnot to try to keep itself afloat. In regards to negotiations that, and this memorandum of understanding that has been signed, yes, look at the whole process of it. First of all, what is missing from this scenario is the people of Iran. Mm-hmm. There's no mention of the executions, the killings, the suppression. It looks like the people of Iran are not part of this equation whatsoever. It's just about Iran's nuclear program and its missile program and whatnot. But the reality is that the underlying factor, the factor that the regime fears the most, is the people of Iran. And when you turn a blind eye on that, it gives a green light to the regime. Since the day of the ceasefire, we're seeing an increase in executions. There have been over 850 executions in the last, I guess, 4 months in Iran, and many political executions, and the international community has been completely silent. I remember last July, 2 political prisoners were executed, and at least 10 countries gave a statement of condemnation. It is minimum, but they did that. This time around, over 30 political prisoners have been executed in a very short time, in the span of a month, and no country, not one single country, has given a statement. Mm. So what is that message to the Iranian regime? Look, we don't want to affect this negotiation because we're afraid of what you're going to do. So we're just going to turn a blind eye. So that means you have a green light. Kill however many people you want. No one's going to talk about it. No one's going to do anything about it. We want to negotiate with you. We want you to stand on your own feet.
Right.
So that's to the Iranian regime and the people of Iran, is that interests speak louder. Mm-hmm. And sorry if that means your livelihood and your life and it just isn't part of the equation. So that is why, like, for instance, the event that we were having was so important, because we were going to draw attention to it. But look, the fact that the Iranian regime goes to this extent to do whatever it can to cancel a rally in Paris, it's thousands of kilometers away from you. What is it that you fear so much? So I think that the Iranian regime actually gave a very important message to the world on Saturday. They showed the world, look, this is the force that I fear the most. They are the alternative. Because with everyone else, the monarchists have forces that they could care less. So it doesn't really affect the regime. The regime knows it's a joke. Everyone knows that they're just a puppet, right? But this force is the force that not to be reckoned with. So they're like, you know what? We are willing to even pay a price for it, because all of this, they know that these things come out in court. They know that we will take these things to court. And the court systems are not the foreign affairs ministry. So they're going to, all that information is going to come out. But they still take that risk. So they're still willing to pay that price. So it shows to the world that, look, that force that the regime fears the most is the people. And we also saw this in January with the uprisings and the fact that the regime opened fire on protesters, killing thousands of thousands in broad daylight. And unfortunately, then they also were able to get away with it because the international community turned a blind eye. I remember, I think it was 3 days after the killings, it was, I think, the third day of the internet blackout, and it was the Davos Forum.
World Economic Forum.
And Araghchi, who was the foreign minister of Iran, was invited. The only reason it got canceled was on the day Iranians were protesting against it so much, the diaspora, that they decided to cancel his presence at the last minute. But the invitation was still there from the beginning. So what was that message to the regime? Look, we know you're going to get through this. We're fine with you. Let's just continue. And so that sends its message. But I think that right before the start of the war, we actually saw something in the week leading up to the war. The week leading up to the war was the 40 days after the protest in Iran. In Iran, culturally, we usually hold ceremonies for the 40th day of the passing of people. And those ceremonies, which were being held across Iran, they all turned into a form of resistance because people were not mourning. Yes, they were sad by the loss of their loved ones, but they were celebrating their lives, and they were actually turned it into a form of resistance and making a pledge to continue the path of their children, because they knew that, look, if we don't, again, the regime buys time for about 2-3 years until the next spark. And then people come to the streets again, and then they're going to be brutally killed. And then again, another 2-3 years. So they understood that we have to end this cycle. And that means we have to continue. Also, that Saturday, actually, the Saturday before the start of the war, exactly 1 week before the war, was the start of university classes resuming in person, because since the uprisings, all classes had been held online, everything was remote, and no one was allowed to be on campus. So campuses resumed classes. That first day, not the second day, on that first day, protests broke out in all universities, and actually over 30 universities across Iran. And 2 days later, resistance units, 250 members of resistance units, carried out an attack on the headquarters of Khamenei. They were able to infiltrate to that compound, which was protected by over 8,500 security personnel. And that sent a message to people inside Iran that, look, the regime is in a much weaker position that they try to present themselves. They're not even able to hold the most secure location in all of the country during a time that they're on heightened security, because it was 5 days before the start of the war. So I think that was, the message to the people of Iran was, look, from now on, this is what it's going to look like. These two things have to go hand in hand. One is the mass protest, and the second is armed resistance or struggle or whatnot. Right. In whatever form that it may be, it's not guerrilla warfare, it's whatever. But that was like the direction. But when the war started, people can't do anything because they have to take shelter, and the regime is going to use that. So people felt like they were being suppressed on the ground, and then from above, they were also being blocked. So that didn't lead to some kind of a major event in Iran after the death, even though some of the highest figures in this regime have been eliminated, and the regime is, but it didn't lead to the uprising because it's still a state of war in the country. Right. Even right now, those have not been removed.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing from you is based on the MOU you referred to, but even before that, with some of the sanctions that were put on Iran, I suppose the U.S. has played a part in creating more economic issues for the people, and this war didn't help with that. And then even with the MOU, as you mentioned, the focus is on the nuclear piece and the enrichment, right? Which wasn't an issue from what we understand, that there was no plan for Iran to complete the enrichment because that was a fatwa that was passed. So how much of that is true?
That's not true. Okay. The regime was the weapon. They have been. That's just the excuse that they have. The reality is that I think it's really important. This is a very thin line that it's very difficult to understand too, because on one hand, you don't want, at the end of the day, the regime benefited from war to a great extent, because as I said, it created the atmosphere for the regime, or the possibility for the regime to be able to suppress with open hands. So that's why the regime wasn't too sad about the war starting, because it actually also created a smokescreen to divert from attention from the main issue, which was after the uprisings in Iran and everything that was happening. So we had that on one hand. But on the other hand, the people of Iran were suffering from war, so any ways welcomed. I would like to draw your attention actually to a statement that Mrs. Rajavi gave when the memorandum came out, because I think this is the day that they said the memorandum was going to be signed. It was before it, so it has nothing to do with the context of the memorandum, but I think it raises a very important issue. In this statement, Mrs. Rajavi actually stated that the Iranian resistance, which for nearly five decades has sought freedom and peace and has through 133 revelations in the last 35 years, acted as the most important barrier in preventing the ruling theocracy from acquiring the nuclear weapons, welcomes any understanding to end the war and the suffering of the Iranian people. In Iran, no one except the remnants of the mullahs and the Shah have wanted or wants war. The effort to produce nuclear weapons, warmongering and meddling in the countries of the region are part of the survival strategy of the religious fascism ruling Iran, and it will not abandon them as long as it can. So war is the regime's shield against popular uprisings, while peace and a ceasefire are, as Khomeini put it back in 1988 when he signed the ceasefire with Iraq, like poison for it. The overthrow of the regime is the responsibility of the Iranian people and their organized resistance. And she also added that, I reiterate once again, that any international agreement to end the war must include an end to the execution of political prisoners and the killing of protesters. So she drew attention to that aspect of it, that human rights aspect, the people of Iran aspect that was missing from this memorandum, but also understanding that, look, the regime strives on crisis. So that's why any kind of peace talks or memorandum of understanding is a step forward for the people. Even though you can go into the mechanisms and details and say, what does this add, that what didn't exist before the war, or what that, all of that is true, but that's a different discussion. But I think it's really important to understand in this current context why that's important, because putting an end to the war really ties the hands of the regime in suppressing the people of Iran.
Okay. You've talked the protests in January. There's, again, mixed information around it. There's also speculation that it was being sponsored by outside forces, and even the numbers of executions has been exaggerated. So there's been conversations around it was 40,000 people that were executed. What's the real story behind it from your perspective?
I think that, as you mentioned, there were those who, I guess, wanted to just muddy the waters in a way, to get their own benefits from it. The reality is that the people of Iran revolted for a reason, because, first of all, they protested for a reason and came to the streets. It started with the strike by the bazaar because of the economic situation. Within 24 hours, it started to spread through the universities. And once the universities joined, it was already the span of different generations coming together in these protests. And so it spread pretty quick to other areas of Iran and was concentrated on the overthrow of the regime. There were those who tried to swing it into this is in support of Pahlavi or whatever, which was not the case. And in fact, it's noteworthy to state this, that till day 10 of the uprising, Reza Pahlavi was on winter vacation. So he wasn't even present anywhere, and he was enjoying his vacation. He had nothing to do with the protest. And the day he came back, he said, oh, I asked you to come to the streets at 8 p.m. on January 7th and 8th. The people were coming to the streets at 8 p.m. every night because that's when it gets dark, and that's for security reasons. That's the best time because there's a lot of CC cameras throughout Iran that they use for control. So at night, it's better protection for people. And unfortunately, yes, there were those players who, after the crackdown, they tried to use the pain and suffering of the people of Iran as propaganda to justify a war. But the reality is that thousands of people were killed because of the internet blackout. It's very difficult to have an exact assessment. The Iranian resistance, at first they said 3,000, then they said it's more than 3,000, but we have the names of about 2,600 people who've been killed. What are the exact numbers? Unfortunately, because at least half of 2026, the people of Iran have been in a communication blackout, it's very difficult to have an exact assessment of that. But the numbers are not these things that, like, and you know what? I think it's very disrespectful because 3,000 is a lot of people who've been killed, or more than 3,000 that we've stated. That is already too much. One life is too much, right? You can't just play with numbers like that. I've heard things from going from 20,000 to 90,000 to even 100,000. Coming from the monarchist camp. And it's just to justify. First of all, they were trying to put pressure, because this is the thing. I explained to you why war is not the solution, right? Mm-hmm. We can say that because we know that the people of Iran have the capability and the potential to bring about change, because our resistance, we have organized resistance in Iran. It's not like there isn't anyone on the ground or people who are willing to pay that price. But in the monarchist camp, because they don't have anything on the ground, they don't have organizational structure, they don't have a strategy they have none of that. So what do they resort to is, okay, Reza Pahlavi actually in an interview said, they asked him, are you willing to go to Iran if the situation, this is during the uprising, are you willing to go to Iran if the situation comes about? And he said, it would have to be orchestrated well. The fact that is your first response, like that is the sentence, it has to be orchestrated well. It means that you, like your father and your grandfather, depend on being installed in Iran. So to be installed, you need the US or Israel to attack Iran. So I don't think under any normal circumstances, I don't think you'll find people who are willing to have their own people and their own country bombed. But they were pushing for it by manipulating these numbers and presenting these things. And I think that is something that in history they're going to have to respond for. Mm-hmm. It came at great cost for the people.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I want to shift it to more on your personal perspective. You're Muslim, so when we spoke, you'd mentioned it's not an issue about the religion itself. It's how the religion is being used to suppress people. And there's always bad actors who take and interpret things for their own benefit at times. And that's been there from the beginning of time. So from your perspective, what does Iran need? Because there's, on the outside, people will often talk about the religion itself being a problem. How do you piece all of that together? And what is your message for people who don't necessarily understand the full picture? And obviously, based on our conversation today, there's a lot of details and nuance, and we haven't even scratched the surface, right? So you've helped me and hopefully the audience understand the complexity behind the situation that we don't have a full picture on. But what would your message be, and how do you bring it together for yourself? And what is your hope for Iran?
I think that, as I mentioned before, the misuse of religion is very dangerous in any country or in any circumstances, and we've seen it throughout history. Today, the issue is in Islam. And on one hand, you have the misuse of religion being used as a political tool. And the other thing is Islamic fundamentalism, which is also what we mentioned, not from the 2000s, but from 1995, we told the world the new global threat is Islamic fundamentalism. And unfortunately, it fell on deaf ears back then. And people started realizing it after 9/11. But the reality is that we are, like, for instance, the People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran, which is the biggest, largest organization among the forces against this regime. And it's also the principal organization, which is a member of the National Council of Resistance of Iran. The PMOI, they are based on their ideology is rooted in Islam, but they believe in a democratic Islam. They believe that as a pillar, like a very key pillar, is separation of religion and state in a country. And in fact, if you look at the 10-point plan presented by Mrs. Rajavi, which serves as a roadmap for the future of Iran, number 5 in that 10-point plan is separation of religion and state. And I think that is very key. But I think that also it's very important that, in fact, the fact that we have the main organization that is fighting this theocratic regime is a Muslim force, that it's able to make that differentiation between actual Islam and the misuse of Islam. I think that's very important. And I think that is the antithesis, because the regime has always played this card that, oh, you don't understand that this is our culture, this is our religion to the West. You want to enforce your own type of democracy to us. Democracy is democracy. It doesn't have a Western style and an Eastern style or whatever. But that is what the regime, that's the narrative that they feed, right? So it's really important to have a force, a democratic force, that believes in separation of religion and state, even though personally they may have religious beliefs. I think there's also a difference between when we say separation of religion and state, that doesn't mean that there can't be organizations who have religious beliefs. Like, for instance, we have in many Western governments, we have Christian democratic parties or whatever. That's in a country that's secular. That is different from separation of religion and state. And that is fine. I think with Iran, it was really important to see that the main force that has fought against this regime have been Muslims. The main victims of this regime have been Muslims. From the 120,000 people who've been executed for supporting this movement, for the most part, they haven't been Muslims. So in fact, they have been the first line fighting the regime. I think it's very noteworthy. There are images of it and actually statements. Like, for instance, when Khomeini said he tried to implement the forced hijab, it was the first organization that gave a statement denouncing it was the PMO, the MEK. So this Muslim force that many of their women actually have a hijab, they were like, no, this is wrong. And in fact, the women's protest, which was the first protest after the 1979 revolution, it was the women's protest against the compulsory veil. The masses of women who are protesting, and the women with scarves, they have created a human chain around them to protect them, to make sure that they're not being attacked by the hooligans of Khomeini. And I think that is the beauty of a secular government, because I think Mr. Rajavi always reiterates that there should be no force in religion, no force in no compulsory government, mm-hmm. and force or no compulsion in hijab. Mm-hmm. I think that those are very important, because the reason that I emphasize on hijab here is because the Iranian regime is a misogynist regime, and they have used misogyny as the cornerstone of their system to be able to infiltrate in the most personal aspect of people's lives. Because if you have control over half of society, then you have control over all of society. And if you're able to dictate to people even how to dress or how to be seen in public or their rights, you can't travel without the permission of your husband or a male guardian or this and that. That really automatically enchains half of society. So that way it's easier to control all of society. And that is what the regime strives on. And I think that's really important to understand. Here is why it also becomes very important, the fact that the Iranian resistance truly believes in women's empowerment as a key factor in the fight against this regime. The MEK that I just mentioned, since 1989, all of their secretary generals have been women. The entire leadership council of the MEK are completely women. And 52% of the NCRI are women. The president-elect of the NCRI is a woman. And women, we truly see women as a force for change, because I think that the fact that we have women in hegemony, that is the antithesis to a misogynist regime. And in fact, I think the emancipation of human beings goes through empowerment of women, especially in political arena. And that has been the experience of the Iranian resistance since 1985 till today.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sharing all of that. What is your hope moving forward?
My hope is that through our dedication and activities, we will be able to see the dawn of freedom soon in Iran. We always also remember that it's always darkest before dawn, but not giving up and not giving in. But I think it's really important. I think a lot of people these days are wondering, what can we do? Or what role can we play, possibly? Because this isn't just affecting the people of Iran anymore. It's affecting the whole world, really. I think it's really important to raise awareness, also to inform, and also to ask others to echo the voice of the people of Iran. Like, for instance, reach out to your lawmakers. Tell them there is a third option on Iran. It's not war or appeasement, because a lot of times it falls into these internal differences that there are between different parties, especially during election years and whatnot, to try to differentiate between those two and just be like, look, this is the situation in Iran. The solution to Iran, which is to the benefit of everyone, is no war, no appeasement, support the people of Iran. The people of Iran don't have to choose between a theocracy and a monarchy, which was a dictatorship, they have the right to move forward to a secular democratic republic in Iran. And I think that those are very key and that's important. The people of Iran said they're not asking for, we're not asking for troops on the ground, we're not asking for financial help, we're not asking for any of that. But don't revert back to negotiating with the regime and appeasement now that you've seen that war is not the response. Unfortunately, that is what's happening right now. It's important to amplify the voice of the Iranian people. Give them that opportunity. Don't use them as bargaining chips. What we saw this weekend was how the people of Iran are used as bargaining chips at the negotiation table. The Iranian regime pushes for it. They give into it, be it for interest or be it out of intimidation. It doesn't make a difference. At the end of the day, you're giving into the demands of a ruthless dictatorship.
Yeah. No, I appreciate all of that. So your biggest takeaway message, I would suppose, is for all of us to gain more awareness around this issue. And what are some ways people can learn more about the work you're doing, or if they wanted to perhaps even reach out to you, what are some ways they can do that?
To learn more about the movement, you could visit -iran.org or mariam-rajavi.com or mariamrajavi4change.com. If you would like to become involved, there is a lot of possibilities, actually. There, if you are in the U.S., you could reach out to OIAC, it's Organization of Iranian American Communities, OIAC.org. They have chapters in over 40 states. So you're probably covered there, and they could put you in contact with local chapters. In Canada and Europe, UK, if you reach out to IranFreedom.org, they could put you in contact with local chapters. And so you could be active with them. We do carry out a lot of different types of work, be it from exhibits, picket lines, work on in parliaments around the world. So there's a lot of work that is being done, and every help is greatly appreciated. And if you would like to reach out to me directly, I am available on X, Instagram, LinkedIn. If you search my name, it should come up.
Well, thank you again for this conversation. I really appreciate the insight you provided and so much information. Like I said earlier, we only scratched the surface. There's so much complexity behind this situation, but I wish you the best of luck and continued success in your journey as you continue to take this on, including the people you do work with. So, but yeah, thank you again for having this conversation with me today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity and for your patience in taking in all of this information. We greatly appreciate it, and we hope that soon we will see the dawn of freedom in Iran.
Thank you for checking out this episode with Zolal. As always, please subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. That's the best and easiest way to support this podcast. And on Apple and Spotify, you can leave up to a 5-star review. Please check out the sponsors in the description, as well as the Easy Reflections newsletter, a zero-cost newsletter that goes out weekly, where I explore different mental health topics and provide practical tips and insights for the reader to implement. The link to the newsletter can be found in the show note captions, where you can subscribe directly. Thank you again, and until next time.